You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 4th of August 2022 on Monocle 24.
Conspiracy theorist shock jock Alex Jones performs to an unimpressed audience. Another step possibly towards normalisation of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, and the airline that seems to have found a way through the post-pandemic chaos. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Alex von Tunzelmann and Yossi Meckelberg will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll hear from Ukraine's Minister for Digital Transformation about how his country has stayed online while under attack. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by the historian, author, and screenwriter Alex von Tunzelmann, and by Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House. Hello to you both.
Hello.
This is usually the part of the show where we try to do a bit of light introductory banter prior to ploughing on with subjects which are often very serious, if not outright depressing. But today we actually have a story to start with, which in its way is quite upbeat and quite, I don't know, cheerful, sort of. So shall we just do it?
Go for it.
Let's do it. Because between a still guttering pandemic, a collapsing climate, a wheezing global economy, a war in Europe, tension in the South China Sea, and whatever other portent of apocalypse is darkening your horizon, 2022 has been short on light relief. So for possibly the first time, we as a world owe a considerable debt to Alex Jones, volcanically fulminating host of ridiculous American conspiracy network InfoWars, who has furnished one of those moments at which one would require the proverbial heart of stone not to laugh out loud. Mr. Jones is currently in the dock of a Texas court being sued by the parents of a child killed in the 2012 Sandy Hook school massacre, a crime Jones has repeatedly told his Yahoo legions was a hoax. Jones' defense is proceeding, it is fair to say, suboptimally. Here is the parents' lawyer with some news.
Mr. Jones, did you know that 12 days ago, your attorneys messed up and sent me an entire digital copy of your entire cell phone with every text message you've sent for the past 2 years, and when informed, did not take any steps to identify it as privileged or protect it in any way. And as of 2 days ago, it fell free and clear into my possession, and that is how I know you lied to me when you said you didn't have text messages about Sandy Hook. Did you know that?
I told you the truth. This is your Perry Mason moment. I gave them my phone, and then...
Mr. Jones, you need to answer the question.
No,
did you know this happened?
No, I didn't know this happened. But, I mean, I told you. I gave them the phone over.
There was so much more of that, and it's all absolutely unreservedly recommended, though it does, it loses a little something without the video, which I do commend to anybody who hasn't already watched it 50 times. Yossi, first of all, there are two possible explanations for this, and I can't decide which is the funnier. One is that Alex Jones' legal team actually are so inept that they mistakenly sent the contents of his phone to the opposition and then didn't bother to chase it up when they were told. Or the other is that his own legal team just thought, you know what, screw this guy. I don't. Which of those do you think is funnier?
It's the kind of situation that half of you laughs and half of you cry, and you don't know.
Because most of me is laughing.
Yeah, but the problem is that the joke is on us.
Kind of.
And at the end of the day, had it not ended with a president a few years ago that is a kind of supporter of all this, of all these conspiracy theories, and made exactly the same, it would be really funny. And you know why you provide the defense with all of, the prosecutor with all of this information? Actually, they should have cut short the trial, save people money and time, and just whatever he should pay them, $150 million should go up probably $200, $300 million. I don't want to intervene in the court case because I don't have that money. But at the end of the day, if you look, the problem is, it's, you know, before him there was Rush Limbaugh. And and Alex Jones, all these guys have tremendous influence. And at the end of the day, they will argue just now before the midterm election that this is a conspiracy too. And then why they should vote for certain candidates. So this is going to roll and roll again until it can break somehow between this fake news and all this. I hate to use conspiracy and theory in the same in the same sentence, because theory is a well-established, founded, researched data, and this is the opposite. But there is a real danger here for American society if this goes on and on and on, let alone how revolting and vile is a person to do something to family grieving their children.
Well, indeed so. The latest from the trial is that the jury is now considering its verdict in this case. And this is not a criminal trial. This is, of course, the defamation case brought by the parents of that Sandy Hook victim. But just picking up on what Yossi said there, Alex, just wondering if there might be something here in this trial, a lesson for how we can deal with conspiracy theorists and grifters and hucksters like Alex Jones. Find a way, put them in a court, make them say it under oath. Because Jones, during proceedings so far, has already conceded that the Sandy Hook massacre, in his own words, was 100% real. It actually happened.
I think that's the reason that some of us are enjoying this, even though Yossi's quite right, that some, you know, subject matter is actually pretty disturbing in many ways, is because for the first time in a very long time, there's some sense that one of these people is actually getting a bit of a comeuppance, some consequences to these constant lies, disinformation and, you know, fake news, which, of course, is a Donald Trump coined term, but it's always projection, isn't it? You know, fake news is
always with Donald Trump, it's projection.
Is what they trade in. And, you know, I think what's sort of so extraordinary is to watch finally there's being some sense of there being some consequences to these really appalling actions and statements. And I must say, I really feel that at the moment I've just got this huge crush on Judge Gamble, who's been presiding over it, who's clearly just had enough completely of the situation. I mean, the wonderful line about, you have to tell the truth here, Mr. Jones, this is not your show. You know, I mean, she has just had enough of the whole business. And, you know, I think it's wonderful to see these things articulated when many of us have sort of been thinking them. You know, finally the sense that actually there is some authority here that will actually not tolerate complete lies.
Well, Yossi, you were saying, and depressingly, you're probably quite right, that some of Alex Jones's fans will perceive this as, you know, the deep state or whoever bringing their man down. But is it not possible, is it too much to hope, that among his audience there might be people who see their man just completely, abjectly humiliated in this fashion and start to think, maybe this guy's side is not the one I want to be on?
I hope so. I hope it's not a wishful thinking on our side. Because if you see a lot of the conspiracies that he spread, this is not the only one. There was another case of school massacre. Mm-hmm. Whether it's COVID-19, whether it's JFK. I don't know if he's part of those who still believe that the earth is flat.
Not sure where he is on the moon landings either, if I'm honest.
On moon landing, yeah. For this sense. But on Hillary Clinton and Pizzagate, definitely pushing. And there is still audience to think of the most ludicrous issues. So there is an audience there. They so hate the liberals, they will believe in anything and everything that's said about them and about the conspiracy. And they hate government as such. Their interpretation of the Constitution is that government is bad by nature, and the more we limit government, the better. And this is the result.
I'm not even sure they've thought it that far through.
It's ingrained in the way they think, and they used to think, because they like only, out of the Constitution, they like only two, and both of them misinterpret the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. So that's what I can say whatever I like, regardless. I can burn the Quran books. I can insult and hurt people just because it's my right to say it. And then I might even shoot them because it's in the Second Amendment.
Alex, just before we move reluctantly off this subject, there is possible further hilarity to descend, because quite a lot of law enforcement agencies have already publicly expressed an interest in the contents of Alex Jones's phone, especially the U.S. Congressional Committee investigating the events of January 6th, 2020, which Jones, of course, did a great deal to fly him up. We will find out more, I'm sure, in due course. But dare we dream what else might be hidden on Alex Jones's phone, who he might have been corresponding with on or around January 6th, 2020 in particular?
Well, yes, I think it might already have been subpoenaed, actually, by that team. And I mean, you know, I mean, as you say, do we dare even dream what might be on there? But let's be honest, Alex Jones is a very, very significant figure in that whole movement, very well connected within that movement. You know, you can easily go online and see kind of him, you know, cozying up with all sorts of people, you know, from the Trump movement, you know, whether it's Steve Bannon or, you know, all of these kind of cronies of Trump. And, you know, so clearly he was in communication with them. So it will be very interesting to see what's on there, especially as some of those January 6th text messages elsewhere seem to have disappeared very strangely.
Extraordinarily. And yes, these were all the people who were getting terribly upset a few years ago about one woman's private email server. We will doubtless follow that story as more details emerge. But for now, you travel to Ukraine, and one of the more miraculous things you'll discover is something most of us take for granted, that you still have phone and data reception. Despite Russia's ongoing invasion, over the past 5 months, Ukraine's digital infrastructure has held up surprisingly well. Monocle's Chris Chermak now reports from a meeting in Kiev with Mikhailo Fedorov, the country's minister for digital transformation.
The most important thing we did before the invasion was to build a system of cyber defense, and for the moment, all of our systems are working properly.
This is Mikhailo Fedorov, Ukraine's minister for digital transformation. He's a man in demand. We're the sixth of 15 meetings, and it's only just gone past midday. Such is the life of a minister in wartime. When you joined the government, did you ever imagine yourself being in this kind of situation?
Of course, I didn't imagine there'd be a war. I imagined that I would be at war with officials and bureaucrats. From the very beginning, I've been in this bureaucratic struggle, but I think that when it comes to reforming the system, we were winning. And the same will happen in the war against Russia.
How challenging has it been to keep the internet functioning, to keep communications functioning across the country in this time?
What was crucial is that we have a market economy. We did not have a state or company monopoly over the internet. We have a lot of providers competing and who are interested in providing unfettered access to their consumers.
Fedorov tells us that Ukraine has been quick to repair connections where access was cut. And then there's Starlink, table-sized terminals that offer internet connections via satellites and have been provided by Elon Musk of Tesla. Fedorov says more than 13,000 Starlink terminals are spread across Ukraine. But it's hardly just Elon Musk keeping things going. Ukraine has a history of digital literacy and companies at the forefront of digital trends. The country is also known for providing back-office services to major tech companies. For Fedorov, these connections have served Ukraine well during the war.
In Ukraine, we already had a high level of digital literacy. We also launched a special tax regime for IT professionals, and we had established contacts with a lot of big tech companies. So when the war started, and we needed to enlist the help of those contacts, we didn't have to start from scratch. We were already in touch.
So that's step one, keeping the internet running and keeping your cyber defenses up. Step two has been providing essential services for Ukrainian citizens, even in wartime.
The most important service we launched allows people to apply for financial support in areas affected by the fighting. Another tool allows for people to ask for a refund for their damaged property. And the third tool is called Chivaro, which means enemy. That allows people to report the movement of the enemy.
All of these new services he mentions are part of a state-funded app on your phone called Dia. It was launched before the war and is now used by 18 million Ukrainians for everything from paying taxes to getting subsidies for small businesses to paying speeding tickets. Fedorov, himself a former entrepreneur, says the app has been expanded to include digital identification documents, and he's clearly proud of its functions.
What makes us unique is actually we are sourcing our inspiration not from how government services work in other countries, but how businesses work efficiently, how they can be friendly for the user. We want to do the same with the state services.
So that's step two, keep essential services running online. Step three involves tackling disinformation and documenting war crimes happening across the country. One aspect of this has been providing police and the military with the digital tools to document war crimes as they happen. But Fedorov says this is also where Ukrainian citizens have perhaps played the biggest role, both in getting the message out and in documenting the aftermath of attacks.
We have launched some digital campaigns to support the brand of Ukraine, such as Be Brave Like Ukraine or United 24. But citizens are also generating a lot of content that is spreading virally. That also helps to get the message out. So it's not just our effort, but the effort of our citizens.
So that's step three, keep a record of what's been happening. Step four, well, that would be reforming and rebuilding the country for after the war.
We want to be able to provide all public services without the participation of bureaucrats. We want to make all services automated, and digitalization is the best instrument to achieve that. We enacted similar reforms in the construction industry, where at many stages there is now no participation of bureaucrats or officials.
There is one final stage. Step five is about the future, serving as an example to other countries.
We see from surveys of Ukrainians who had to flee abroad that one of the things they appreciate most about Ukraine compared to other countries is our level of digitalization. And I think it's a great achievement that we managed to obtain in just a couple of years.
With Ukraine having been granted official candidate status by the European Union, Fedorov says he believes Ukraine has something to offer, particularly the state-backed DIA app. Fedorov says he's in talks with European neighbors about how they too can develop the application for their own countries. And just final question, what do you love about Ukraine personally? What do you love or what do you find most special about Ukraine?
Напевно, це люди.
It's people. We have a lot of really creative, curious people. The level of creativity and new ideas that they have is just incredible. This is why I believe that even in these circumstances, with a common idea that unites them, Ukrainians can really become an economic miracle for the world.
That was Mykhailo Fedorov, Ukraine's Minister for Digital Transformation, speaking to Monocle's Chris Chermak in Kyiv. Let's bring our panel back in. Yossi, first of all, there's a lot going on there, but I want to talk first of all about whether the world should be looking at Ukraine and learning from how Ukraine has defended itself in the digital realm and how it has used the digital realm to defend itself.
Yeah, in a way, it's one of the first experiences in warfare in which the technology, cutting edge of technology on all spheres, from drones to propaganda, to how to deal with the population, everything with distribution, logistics, is actually done digitally. So in this sense, this provides experience. It's not only about how Ukraine dealing with it, it's how Ukraine and Ukraine with the world are together. Addressing this issue, because one of the things, for instance, for Ukraine is dealing with new technology, especially military technology, very quickly, because they were based on a lot of East European, for instance, military warfare, and all of a sudden they have to switch into more Western, and this, a lot of it is more advanced, more technologically cutting edge, and as a result of it, they learn very quickly. So what you learn also during crisis, necessity, creates also resourcefulness that you see it among the Ukrainian.
Well, Alex, I guess militaries of all sorts as well are going to have to learn to adjust to what we're seeing, and the Starlink terminals are a demonstration of that, the 13,000 of them scattered around the country. This massively decentralized and wireless communications architecture, because as recently, well, one likes to think recently, as, for example, Operation Desert Storm, it was more or less possible to take down an entire country's communications network in a matter of hours. And I think a lot of people assumed that Russia would do that to Ukraine, possibly including Russia. And it turns out it's not that easy.
Absolutely. I mean, Russia did actually attack, I think, several mobile phone masts and so on early on in the campaign. And as we can see, that hasn't actually had that effect. As you say, you cannot wipe out that communications network now in anything like such a straightforward physical way. I'm really impressed with some of the kind of digital stories coming out of Ukraine. There was one particularly as a historian I found deeply moving where, you know, Russia was attacking museums, of course, and so forth. And there was an international effort to go in and download those the museum's whole websites and, you know, archives and everything they digitized, which in Ukraine, a lot of museums have been very effectively digitized, before the Russians could attack them and wipe out the servers. So in some cases, for instance, regional museums who had collections of, you know, photographs of Jewish villages from the early 1900s, those museums are now gone, but somebody has downloaded the website, so those photographs still exist somewhere online. And that's a very interesting development in warfare because, of course, warfare is often about wiping out not just, you know, who's going on, but the heritage and the history and everything.
So, especially when you're waging a war animated at least in part by wishing to deny a nation its existence and deny it its legitimacy.
Exactly so. So, you know, I think this is a very different, a new development that is very interesting to me, how that can be fought.
Yossi, in terms of how both sides have attempted to, you know, get their propaganda, their information across in the online space, what has Ukraine done differently or done right or understood that other countries, and I guess most obviously Russia, have not?
I think actually diametrically opposite the way that they did it. While with Putin, go back, you see, no one falls for this, that Ukraine is a Nazi country run by Nazis, especially that the president is Jewish. It's a bit of contradiction in terms. and so it was stuck with the same kind of dogma of old-fashioned Russian propaganda. While with Zelensky, it's exactly the opposite. He understands the West. He even adjusts every speech. Whenever you go and speak in different parliaments, and is adjusting the speech that it will resonate with their history, with their set of values. So you see someone that is the agility of their, call it propaganda, the way that they explain. I think obviously it's easier to explain Ukraine to explain Russia because it's more difficult why you are an aggressor and you cause, and while you are the one, the victim of all of it, defend your country. But even if you just for a second forget this, you see that they'll be very dogmatic, old-fashioned type of try to influence public opinion, and one which is agile and understand what are the kind of the things that will resonate with people in different countries.
Conversely, and just a final thought on this one, Alex, is Russia actually trying to get their case across to, let's say, the democratic world anymore, or are we just not the audience for what they are serving up?
I think we're much less the audience. I mean, they obviously do kind of have some success with sort of kind of small fans of Alex Jones followers and various conspiracy theorists, but overall, I think their propaganda quite quickly turned around to be mostly internal. And that's where they have probably been more successful. It's very hard to assess from the outside, potentially. But it certainly seems that there is quite large support for Putin and for the war within Russia. But I think that's, you know, in a sense, there's a kind of complexity to that, which is that anytime you put sanctions on a country, you're going to increase a kind of support of that government and of, you know, what's going on. That just seems historically to happen almost everywhere that sanctions are applied. So it's not necessarily just that their propaganda's good. It might be the mechanics of that situation.
OK, well, let's look now at a small step for commercial aviation and potentially a giant leap for diplomacy. Earlier today, Cathay Pacific flight CX-675 from Hong Kong touched down in Tel Aviv, having passed en route through the airspace of Saudi Arabia. It's the first time a civilian flight in or out of Israel to or from a long-haul destination has been permitted to cross the kingdom's skies since they were open to all flights last month. A Cathay plane flying the same route earlier this week, for example, had to go the much longer way around via China, Kazakhstan and Turkey before approaching Ben Gurion Airport from over the Mediterranean. Yossi, there was already a sort of corridor across Saudi airspace to the UAE and Bahrain following the normalisation of relations between them and Israel. So this seems like the logical next step. So, but how big a moment is it?
Not that big a moment.
Come on, Yossi, help us out here. We're going to do at least 5 minutes on this.
No, I'll elaborate.
please do.
I think before we jump for joy, for kind of a, it's a sort of Abraham, a course 30,000 feet up in the air. I think this is not the case. I think the Saudis are, and I think to a large extent, rightly so, taking baby steps.
Mm.
And they adhere to the 2002 Arab initiative, which was a Saudi initiative translated into the Beirut Accords, which states very clearly there is no normalization unless there is a peace agreement with the Palestinians. The Abraham Accord, in many ways, sidelined the Palestinian issue. So let's have normalization. It has its own logic. And let me, I'm not against normalization. I think it's better to have normalization in mm-hmm. international relations, not having normalization. But the question, what happens to the Palestinian issue, which is the core issue, I think, also for Israel, they try to kick it to the side. Now, the Saudis agree to that. If you see, they never mentioned Israel in this. When President Biden visit, which I think was also a missed opportunity, they spoke.
And I think that was the first flight by a foreign leader directly from Tel Aviv to Riyadh. Yeah, or to Jeddah, sorry.
To Jeddah. But what the Saudis said is that we open our skies to anyone that actually adhere to Yatad. rules, which means everyone. So if it happens also Israeli airplanes and everyone comes from Israel, it's fine by us. And probably El Al will take the opportunity and fly over Saudi Arabia. But this doesn't make the changes. For instance, the Biden administration tried to imply before the visit they're going to be a visit from Israel and Saudi Arabia, or they're going to be a military alliance of sort that Israel is out there as a member. This hasn't happened, and I think at least it's also a generational thing in Saudi Arabia, but they adhere to the 2002 initiative, Arab initiative, and I think that's where they stay. There will be small steps there, but I don't see in the foreseeable future that it will change dramatically.
Alex, what do you think? Are we a way off then from being able to board an El Al flight from Tel Aviv to Riyadh?
Well, I mean, that's interesting to hear Yossi say that even El Al, maybe they haven't tried anything yet, have they? Haven't tried to overfly. I mean,
That is apparently pending approval this week.
Yes. Right,
El Al so using Saudi airspace.
So it will happen. It will probably.
But that's flying across Saudi Arabia, not landing in it.
Not landing in it, and you know, an interesting question of who wants exactly to be on an El Al plane making that precise route. You know,
I will be happy to be on this.
Well, I mean, Yossi will be on it. Yeah, exactly.
There is
we've
a
got
first
one.
Passenger.
Yeah, we've got one. And the Saudis were quite clearly playing this down as well, weren't they? I mean, there were a lot of comment from Saudi Arabia. This is not normalization. This is not a step on any kind of route. It's not all of this, which, of course, you know, would be said, was said.
Well, what do you think that is about, though, Alex? Are they trying to manage the Saudi public's mood, trying to gauge as they go along how keen or otherwise the Saudi people might be on normalization?
I think probably it's more intended. I mean, Yossi would be much more of an expert on this than me. My instinct is that's more aimed at the rest of the Arab world rather than particularly the Saudi public. I'm not sure how much they care what the Saudi public think, but the broader Arab world, maybe.
I think they're on two levels. A, yes, it's the public. There is a huge gap between the public still show great empathy towards the plight of the Palestinians, and this is not a great sell. On the other hand, there is also a drive for closer relations with Israel because the issue of Iran, scientific cooperation, economy. So there is kind of push-pull forces working there. But the Saudis still say that it might be also because there is younger generation at the helm in other countries in the Gulf, including the Emirates, than in Saudi Arabia. It might be changing in the future. But I think it's also a principled approach by Saudi Arabia that the Palestinian issue has to be resolved first. If they wanted to change it, they could have changed during the Biden administration and actually helped Biden to get a few brownie points before midterm election, and they didn't.
Just a final quick thought on this, Yossi, and this is one of those things where I basically ask you to solve the Middle East in about 30 seconds, 45 absolute tops. Is there any argument at all that a complete normalisation of relations all round, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Lebanon, Israel, whoever else wants a piece of this, might actually help promote some sort of settlement vis-à-vis Palestine?
You would think. But not everything that we would think is rational in the Middle East, especially between Israel and Palestine, is actually going to happen. You, again, there is logic to this, because Israel always argues we are in an ocean of enemies, that we are surrounded by enemies. As a result, we can't make concession. It will compromise our security. Here we are on the longest border with Jordan. There is peace agreement. Egypt became a strategic ally. The Abraham Accord. The Saudis, there are some, it's not, we're not calling normalization, but good enough rapprochement. So actually, it should, the logic of it is that why won't we take the risk involving a peace agreement and do that? But I think it's actually encouraged the right wing in Israel, and you see the expansion of settlements, the way that the occupation goes. So I'm afraid, no.
Well, on that cheerful note, finally on today's show, we will stick somewhat with the aviation theme, an item which may be of particular interest to listeners tuning into this as they wait at baggage claim while cobwebs gather around their ankles. At least one airline is doing all right-ish. First, let's hear from Monocle's Desiree Bandley.
It's been a tough summer for airlines, facing staff shortages and cancelled flights. But some are faring better than others. Swiss International Airlines, a subsidiary of Lufthansa, reported profits of 68 million euros, moving it out of the red for the first time since the start of the pandemic. That's thanks to a combination of restructuring and boosted sales. It even managed to pay back an emergency bank loan granted by the Swiss government. So far, Swiss has transported 5.3 million travelers this year, more than five times the volume over the same period last year. Its overall earnings have also surged to 1.8 billion euros in the January to June period, up from 675 million in the first half of 2021. Though its overall earnings remain below pre-pandemic levels, strong bookings for the second half of the year suggest 2022 can still be a bright spot for those airlines able to weather the staffing storm.
That was Desiree Bandley. Desiree, thank you for that. We did want to talk to you both about what your experience of returning to the skies or not has been. I mean, I've been reasonably lucky. I've done one long trip to Australia to see family and stuff. There was one baggage mishap where I had that infuriating thing of it literally taking longer to get the bags off the plane and to the conveyor belt than the plane had taken to get from the previous airport to the one I was now in. And I had the one horror day at Heathrow of 3-hour queue for security, followed by 3 hours sitting on an aeroplane before it actually went anywhere. Can either of you compete with that?
Well, I mean, actually, I've deliberately not, because this summer I chose not to travel by plane where possible. I mean, I did have to do a little flight for work, but to Copenhagen. But when I went on vacation, I took the train from London to Barcelona and back, which I recommend overwhelmingly as an alternative. You can do it in a day both ways. You know, leave London slightly red eye at 6 a.m, but you've got your toes in the med by 5 p.m, which is pretty good going on the Barceloneta. So that's the way to go, in my opinion.
That does sound tempting. The flight to and from Copenhagen, they didn't send your bags to Antwerp or Ulaanbaatar or anything like that?
No, I was quite pleasantly surprised that it was sort of okay, but it was, you know, I mean, I had left a lot of time because, but it was before that really big sort of Heathrow pile up with all the baggage. So I think I was lucky to sort of dodge that.
And Yossi, how has it been for you?
I had quite a few flights recently. One was actually a nice surprise to Luxembourg. But probably you can walk to Luxembourg.
When you say you were surprised to go to Luxembourg, was that not where you thought the plane was going?
No. The experience was, I take your point, which was nice from city with Luxembourg. Other experiences were not great. For instance, waiting, coming to the airport 6 o'clock in the morning just to realize that the flight was delayed by 3 hours because the crew couldn't get their PCR results. So a full Boeing 777 waited because they could get actually the result of their PCR, but not the crew.
See, so that's one of those things where I'm torn between admiring the corporate honesty of telling you that's the reason actually just kind of wishing they'd made up something less infuriating.
Though, not only the honesty, a bottle of water and sandwich would be even nicer when you left home at 4:30 in the morning.
Like if they said there's a badger loose on the runway or something, that would be sort of of weirdly adorable and a fun story to tell later?
Probably they should. 3 hours in Schiphol waiting and not knowing if we'll catch the flight or not, because there was complete mayhem. Being actually not a very good experience in Lisbon with trying to charge you for everything for half a kilo, 80 euro, most expensive half a kilo ever paid for anything. So... And the question, you know, if you look at what the Bank of England decided today, we probably won't have money to fly in the next few years. So it's probably overtaken, this story overtaken by events of paying our electricity and gas bills.
Well, we will sign off then with an absolutely crashing plug, because if, despite everything you have just heard, you do decide to fly with Swiss to Zurich, do go and visit Monocle's very own pop-up shop at Zurich Airport. It is awaiting passengers with a collection of local gifts and well-known Monocle staples. And that is it for this edition of Well-Known Monocle Staple, the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Yossi Meckelberg and Alex von Tonzemann. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by Lillian Fawcett and Maya Renfer. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.